This was after the conquest of Aenon, she said. We had tracked a mother and her foal for the better part of an afternoon. But when we finally sighted them, we discovered we weren't the only hunters. Wolves. Wolves had tracked them as well. We climbed a shallow ridge so we could see it all, the Conting mother and her child watering at a black stream, and the wolves closing about her. She glimpsed the predators in her soul's eye, sleek as fish, tunneling through the grasses. But the cow either heard them or caught their scent on the wind. She bolted before the noose could be knotted, bolted directly toward us. It was astonishing enough to watch from a distance. She backed her foal against the earthen drop, immediately below us, turned to battle her pursuers. The wolves flew at her, but Conti are strong, like vicious horses. And she kicked and stamped and butted, and the wolves veered away. I almost cried for jubilation. But Proyas clutched my arm and pointed directly down. She paused to lick her lips behind the porcelain. The wolves, Maetha. The wolves had known what she would do, even where she would run. So even as the cow seemed to frighten off the pack, two others, who had concealed themselves in the thicket at the ridge's base, leapt upon the foal and tore out its throat. The mother shrieked, chased them away, but it was too late. The pack simply waited until she abandoned her child's body. Esmonet really had no idea how much he could infer from the sliver of her voice. She had rehearsed this story to baffle his penetration. She had struggled to purge all sign of passions that moved beneath her voice and intent. But how does one conceal what is already hidden? "Do you understand, Maetha? I need to know you aren't a wolf waiting in the thicket." For a heartbeat, anger and compassion seemed to war for the high ground of his gaze. "How could you think such a thing?" he exclaimed. She breathed deep. How had she come by her suspicions? How often the past seemed a cistern sloshing with dissolved voices. Enrilatus had said she feared Maethanet because she despised herself. How could he not try to save the empire from her incapacity? But something in her balked at the possibility. Her entire life, it seemed, she had fended fears without clear origin. "Just a tactic," she told herself, "an attempt to engage me morally, make me defensive." She tapped the Aenani mask with a lacquered nail, a gesture meant for herself as much as for him. "How?" she replied. "Because you are Dunyane." This occasioned a long silence between them. Watching his pained look lapse into blank scrutiny, Esmonet could not shake the nagging sense that her brother-in-law actually considered murdering her there and then. "Your husband is Dunyane," Maethanet finally said.
"Indeed?"
She wondered if it would be possible to count all the unspoken truths that hung between them, all the devious grounds for their mistrust. Was there ever a family so deranged as theirs? "If I condescend to this test, it will be only to reassure you, Esme," he finally said. His tone was devoid of pride or resentment, a fact that simply made him more inhuman in her eyes. "I am your brother. Even more, I am your husband's willing slave, no different than you. We are bound together by blood and faith."
"Then do this for me, Maetha.
I will apologize if I'm wrong. I will wash your feet in the Zothi steppes. Anything.
Wolves pursue me."
It was all a game for them, she realized. No word, no expression. Simply was. Everything was a tool. A tactic meant to further some occult and devious goal. Even love. Just as Akamian had said. She had known this for years, of course. But in the way of all threatening knowledge, at angles, in the shadowy corners of her soul. But now, playing that game with one of them, with a Dunyane, it seemed she understood that knowledge down to its most base implication. She would be overmatched, she realized, were it not for her mask. Maethanet had paused in the semblance of a man at his wit's end. His jet beard looked hot in the sunlight, She wondered what dye he used to conceal the Nocerai blonde. "And you are willing to trust the judgment of a mad adolescent?"
"I am willing to trust the judgment of my son."
"To read my face." He was trying to extend a conversation, she realized. To better scrutinize her voice. Had something in her tone hooked his interest?
"To read your face."
"And you realize the training this requires?" Esmond nodded toward her daughter. For all her deficits, the Liapa had been her reprieve. She, too, was Dunyane. But as Kel'Momas possessed his mother's capacity to love, so, too, she possessed her mother's need to please. This, Esmond had decided, was what she could trust, those factions of her that had found their way into her children. She would count all the world her enemy otherwise. "The ability to reread passions is largely native," the Liapa said. "And save for father, none can see so deep as Enrilitus. Inferring thoughts requires training, uncle, a measure of which father provided. "But you know this," Esmond added, trying to hide the accusation in an air of honest confusion. Gasping in exasperation, the Shrier of the Thousand Temples fell back in his chair.
"Esme,"
the tone and pose of an innocent, bewildered and bullied by another's irrationality. "If his actions conform to your expectations," Kellis had told her, "then he deceives you. The more unthinkable dissembling seems, Esme, the more he dissembles." Even though her husband had been referring to their son, the words she knew applied all the same to Mathanet. Enrilitus had said it himself. The Dunyane were not human. And so she would play her own mummer's role.
"I don't understand, Matha. If you're innocent, what do you have to lose?"
She already knew what Enrilitus would see in his uncle's face, what he would say. The boy, he could say anything. He's mad. All she needed were grounds.
"He loves his mother."
Before, the young prince had run about the bones of the Endymion Heights. Now he ran through them. The more Kel'Momas thought about it, the more it seemed he always knew that these tunnels existed, that all the subtle discrepancies between dimensions, shortened rooms and too wide walls, had scratched and whispered at the edges of his notice. He did not like to think that ways had been hidden from him. He wandered through the dark. He held a small hand about his candle flame to protect against drafts where he could. But he was not so afraid of losing his way as missing something of interest were the light to flicker out. All eyes, he padded through narrow corridors, a bubble of light slipping through black pipes. Everything he saw bore the strict stamp of his father. Bare surfaces, crude stonework, simple iron. Here and there he came across walls adorned with chapped paint, and once an entire hall that had been vaulted and corniced. Sections of the old Icuri Palace, he realized, that father had bent to his own design. He quickly realized the stairs and halls composed but a small fraction of the complex. For every stair there were at least five tubes set with iron rungs, some climbing, others plumbing depths he had yet dared to go. And for every hallway there were at least a dozen chutes, accessing, he imagined, the palace in its entirety. But there were too many locked doors and grates and hatches. He could almost see mother or father sending agents into these halls, using these portals to control how many bones could be explored. He resolved to teach himself how to pick their locks. Even though he knew he risked his mother's wrath, he decided to explore one of the few unbarred chutes, one leading through the apparatory, he soon discovered. He passed innumerable voices, laughing and gossiping for the most part. He even glimpsed several shadows through tight marble and bronze fretting. He heard a couple making like dogs, and rooting around, he found a crease through which he could watch their sweaty backs heave. "This is the way you are to me," he whispered to the secret voice.
"This is how I am to you."
One bright, one dark.
His eyes, little more than slits, Kelmomus watched the plunging mystery for a time. The smell of it intrigued him, and it seemed he had caught some whiff of it on every man and woman he had met in his entire life, including Mother. Finally, answering to a rising urgency, he began retracing his steps. He happily let his candle gutter out, knowing the route step for step, rung for rung. The musty darkness blew like a breeze through his hair and across his cheeks, so fleet was his passage back to the Empress's apartment. But Mother was waiting for him, her face as immobile as stone for fury.
"Kel, what did I tell you?"
He could duck her strike. He could catch her hand and break any one of her fingers. And while she winced for pain, he could snatch one of the pins fixing her hair and drive it deep into her eye. Death deep. He could do any of these things. But it was better to lean his cheek into her swatting palm, allow the blow to crack far harder than she intended, so that he could weep in false misery while she clutched him, and glory in her love and regret and horror. Satma Nanafiri rose from him, skin peeling from skin. She stood, savored the kiss of cool air across her breasts, felt his seed flush her inner thighs, for her womb would have none of it. His post-coital slumber was deep, so deep he did not stir when she spat her contempt upon him. She could strike him dead, and he would never know. He would writhe in agony for all eternity, thinking he need only awaken to escape. Phanyl ab Cascamandri, blasted to charcoal, time and time again. She barked in laughter. She wandered the gloom of his pavilion, gazed upon the heirlooms of a destroyed empire. A fire-scorched standard, leaning negligently against a chair paneled in mother-of-pearl. Glittering coats of mail hanging from mahogany busts. The Padaraja's body slave, a solemn Nilnameshi, as old as she had once been, cowered in a slot between settees, watching her the way a child might watch a wolf. She paused before the pavilion's small but sumptuous shrine. "You are one of her children," she said without looking at the man. "She loves you despite the wickedness your captors have forced upon you." She drew a finger along the spine of the book nestled in crimson-crushed velvet upon the small altar, the Kipfa Aphon, the witness of Fane. The leather cracked and pimpled at her touch. "You give," she murmured, turning to fix the old man with her gaze. "He takes." Tears greased his cheeks. "She will reach for you when your flesh stumbles, and you are pitched into the outside. But you must reach for her in turn. Only then..." He shrank into his refuge as she stepped toward him. "Will you? Will you reach for her?" He shook his head in affirmation, but she had already turned away, knowing his answer. She sauntered toward the draped entrance, glimpsed herself in the long oval of a standing silver mirror. The Mother Supreme paused in the lantern gloom, allowed her eyes to roam and linger across the supple lines of her reborn body. She made a tongue of her image, savored the honey of what she saw. To be returned, to experience the unfathomable loss, to shrink and wither, and then to bloom anew. Satma Nanafiri had never suffered the vanities of her sisters. She did not hunger, as the others hungered, for the thieving touch of men. Only in the execution of the rites would her flesh rise to the promise of Congress. Even still, she exulted in this gift, as she had no other. There was glory in middle youth, the tested limb and will of maturity, clothed in firm silk years, away from the sackcloth it would become. Her temples looted and burned. So many of her sisters raped and put to the sword, and here she stood, drunk with joy. "Are you such a dog?" she asked the open air. "Eh, snakehead?" She turned to where Mepa stood on the pavilion's threshold. The ornate flaps swayed into motionlessness behind him. Highland cool wafted through the interior. "You," he said with muttering intensity. His face remained directed forward, but the black finger of his salt asp had turned directly toward the cringing body slave. The Mother Supreme smiled, knowing the old man would not live to see dawn. He would die for her sake, she knew, and he would reach. "Always guarding his master's portal," she cackled. "Cover yourself, concubine. You do not like what you see. I see the withered old crone that is your soul. So you are a man still, eh, snakehead? You judge my beauty, my worth, according to the youth of my womb. My still your tongue! Bark, dog. Rouse your master. Let's see whose snout he will strike." The shining snake finally turned to regard her. The lips beneath the silver band tightened into a line. Satma Nanafiri resumed her appraisal of her miraculous twin in the mirror. "You bear the water within you," she said to the last Kisharim. She drew a palm across the plane of her abdomen. "Like an ocean, you can strike me down with your merest whim, and yet you stand here bandying threats and insults." "I serve my lord Padiraja." The Mother Supreme laughed. This, she realized, was her new temple, a heathen army, flying through lands where even goat herds were loath to go. And these heathen were her new priests, these Fainim. What did it matter what they believed, so long as they accomplished what needed to be done? "But you lie," she croaked in her old voice. He has been anointed, she cackled. "But not by whom you think. Cease your fool! All of them, all of these men, all these thieves, all of them think themselves the center of their worlds. But not you. You have seen. You alone know how small we are, mere specks, motes in the gusting black. And yet you place your faith in errant abstraction? The solitary god? Pah! You throw number sticks for your salvation, when all you need to do is kneel." The Kisharim said nothing in reply. The salt asp, lantern light gleaming along the cross hatching of its scales, hooked away from her toward a point over her shoulder. She turned to see Fanail standing naked in a kind of stationary lurch behind her. He seemed insubstantial for the play of shadow and gloom. "Do you see now?" Mepa asked. "Her treachery. Her devilry. My lord, please tell me that you see." Fanail Ab Kaskamandri wiped his face, breathed deep, his nostrils whistling. "Leave us, Mepa," he said roughly. A moment of equipoise followed. The mutual regard of three overbearing souls. Their breathing abraded the silent air. Then, with the merest bow, the Kisharim withdrew. Padiraja loomed behind the diminutive woman. He flung her about, cried, "Witch!" He clamped calloused hands about her neck, bent her back, crying, "Accursed witch!" Groaning, the Mother Supreme clutched his hard-muscled arms, hooked a naked calf about his waist. Thus he ravished her. Still huddled between the settees, the doomed body-slave wept for watching. Soft earth, deeply ploughed. Scant memory greeted Uncle Holy's arrival at the Endymion Heights' postern gate. Only somber words, an unspoken suspicion. Slaves raised embroidered tarps against the rain, forming a tunnel with upraised arms, so Mathanet was spared the indignity of soaking in his own clothes. Kelmomas was careful to observe and mimic the attitude of his mother and her retinue. Children, no matter how oblivious otherwise, are ever keen to their parents' fear and quick to behave accordingly. Kel-Momus was no different. Something truly momentous was about to happen. Even his mother's fool ministers understood as much. Kel-Momus actually glimpsed crooked old Vem-Mithridi, shaking his head in disbelief. The Shrier of the Thousand Temples was about to be interrogated by their god's most gifted, destructive son. Uncle Holy paced the dripping gauntlet in the simulacrum of fury. He fairly shouldered aside Imhalus and Lord Sancus to stand before Mother, who even so diminutive seemed imposing for the strangeness of her shining white mask. Not for the first time, Kel-Momus found himself hating his uncle, not simply because of his stature, but because of the way he occupied it. No matter what the occasion, be it a blessing or a marriage, or an exhortation, or the whelming of a child, Anna Sarimber Mathanet cultivated an aura of neck-breaking strength. "Dispense with the frivolities," he snapped. "I would be done with this, Esme." He wore a white robe with gold-embroidered hems, stark, even by his staid standards. Aside from the heavy tusk and circumfix that hung above his sternum, his only concessions to ornament were the golden vam-braces that sheathed his forearms in antique Canaan motifs. Rather than speak, the Empress lowered her head a degree short of what was demanded by Janaine. Kel-Momus felt her hand tighten about his shoulder as she did so. The young Prince Imperial savored the way they carried the scent of rain into the closeted halls of the palace. Moist creases of silk and felt, feet squishing in sandals, wet hair growing hot. Neither party spoke a word the entire trek, save Vem-Mithridi, who begged his mother's pardon as soon as they climbed beyond the apparatory, asking whether he could continue on his own at a pace more suitable to ancient bones. They left the frail Sake schoolman behind them, following a path of stairs and corridors cleared in advance and guarded at every turn by stone-faced Aothic guardsmen. The wall sconces were idle, despite the darkness of the day, so they passed through pockets of outright gloom. Despite his mother's fixed forward glare, the young Prince Imperial could not resist craning about, matching the ways he could see with the ways he could not, comparing the two palaces, visible and invisible. At long last they gained the Imperial apartments and reached the door. It seemed taller and broader than the boy remembered, perhaps because his mother had finally ordered it polished. Normally chalked in green, the Kyranian lions now gleamed in florid majesty. He wanted to ask Mother whether this meant Enrilitus would be set free, but the secret voice warned him to remain silent. The Empress stood before them, her masked face lowered as if in prayer. All was silent, save for the creak of Imhalus's gear. Kel-Momus reached about her silk-girdled waist to press his cheek into her side. She ran thoughtless fingers through his hair. Finally, Mathan had asked, "Why is the boy here, Esme?" No one could miss his tone, which twisted the question into, "What is this morbid fixation?"
"I don't know," she replied.
"Enrilitus refused to speak to you unless he was present." "So this is to be a public humiliation?" "No, only you and my two sons," she replied, still gazing at the door. "Your nephews." "Madness," the Shrier muttered in feigned disgust. At last she turned her mask toward him.
"Yes," she said.
"Dunyane madness." She nodded to Imhalus, who grasped the latch and pushed the great door inward. The Shrier of the Thousand Temples looked down to Kel-Momus, clasped his small white hand in the calloused immensity of his own. "Do you fear me as well?" he asked. Rather than reply, the boy looked to his mother in the appearance of anxious yearning.
"You are a Prince Imperial," his mother said. "Go."
He followed Uncle Holy into the gloom of his brother's cell. The cell's lone window was unshuttered, revealing a slot of dark sky, and flooding the room with chill and moist air. Rain was all the boy could hear at first, roaring across complicated rooftops, gurgling and slurping down the course of zigzag gutters. A single brazier warmed the room, pitching an orange glow into the dark. An elaborately carved chair had been set facing the wall where Enrilatus's chains hung from the four stone lion heads. The brazier had been positioned, the boy noticed, to fully illuminate the chair's occupant, and no one else. Enrilatus crouched naked some 4 paces from the chair, his arms about his knees. The dim light did not so much illuminate as polish him, it seemed. The young man watched them from a kind of blank serenity.
"We must discover what he wants us to do," the secret voice whispered.
For certainly Enrilatus wanted something from him. Why demand his presence otherwise? His uncle released his hand the instant the door creaked shut behind them. Without so much as looking at either brother, he reached into his left sleeve and extracted a wooden wedge from beneath the antique vambrace. He dropped it clattering to the floor, then kicked it beneath the base of the door, locking them in. Enrilatus laughed, flexing his arms as smooth and hard as barked branches. "Uncle Holy," he said, bending his head to press his left cheek against his knees. "Truth shines." "Truth shines," Mathenet replied, taking the seat provided for him. Kelmomus peered at the wooden butt jammed into the black seam between the floor and the portal.
What was happening?
It had never occurred to him that Uncle Holy might have plans of his own.
"Shout," the secret voice urged. "Call for her."
The boy shot a questioning look at his older brother, who simply grinned and winked. Raw for the rain, distant thunder reverberated through the cell window. But for the little boy, the crazed proportions of the circumstances that seized them rattled louder still. What was happening? "Do you intend to murder Mother?" Enrilatus asked, still staring at Kelmomus. "No," Mathenet replied.
"We have missed something," the voice exclaimed.
"Something has..." "Do you intend to murder Mother?" Enrilatus asked again, this time fixing his uncle in a cartwheeling gaze. "No. Uncle Holy, do you intend to murder Mother?" "I said no." The boy breathed against the iron rod of alarm that held him rigid. Everything was explicable, he decided. Enrilatus played as he always played, violating expectations for violation's sake. His uncle had stopped the door for contingency's sake. The little boy almost laughed aloud. They were all Dunyane here. "So many years," Enrilatus continued, "piling plots atop plots. Could it be you have simply forgotten how to stop Uncle?" "No. So many years surrounded by half-witted peoples. How long have you toiled? How long have you suffered for these malformed children with their stunted intellects? How long have you suffered their ignorance, their absurd vanity? And then Father, that slovenly ingrate, raises one of them above you? Why might that be? Why would Father trust a whore over the pious Shrier of the Thousand Temples? I know not, but you suspect. I fear my brother does not fully trust me, because he knows, doesn't he? He knows the secret of our blood. Perhaps he knows you better than you know yourself. Perhaps. And he has seen the flicker of sedition, the small flame that waits the kindling of circumstance. Perhaps. And have the circumstances arrived? No. Laughter. Oh, but Uncle Holy, they have arrived, most certainly. I do not understand. Liar! The wild-haired figure screeched. The Shrier did not so much as blink. His face, bathed in wavering orange light, Mathanet enveloped in Rillitus in Dunyane scrutiny, a gaze that seemed to tinkle like coals. It was a profile Comomus had seen a thousand times, stitched into banners if not flesh. High of cheek, virile, the strength of his jaw obvious despite the thickness of his beard. "Here is our first true challenge," the voice whispered. "We must take care." In Rillitus's eyes glittered in the gloom. He crouched the same as before, his chains hanging in arcs across the floor. If their uncle's scrutiny discomfited him, he betrayed no sign of it. "Tell me, Uncle Holy, how many children did Grandfather sire?" "Six," the Shrier replied. There was a toneless brevity to the exchange now, as if they had shed the disguises they used when interacting with normal men. "Were any of them like me?" A fraction of a heartbeat. "I have no way of knowing. He drowned them at the first sign of peculiarities."
"And you were the only one that expressed balance?"
"I was the only one."
"So, Grandfather, he would have drowned me?"
"Most certainly." The stark appraisal of a Dunyane, directly to the point, careless of pride or injury. In an arena packed with the blind and the beggared, he and his family were the only sighted players. They played as the blind played, goading, commiserating, flattering, simply because these were the moves that moved the blind. Only when they vied one against another, the young Prince Imperial realized, could they dispense with the empty posturing and play the game in its purest, most rarefied form. "So why," Enroitus asked, "do you think Father has spared me?" The Shrier of the Thousand Temples shrugged. "Because the eye of the world is upon him. Not because of Mother. She watches with the rest."
"But you do not believe this."
"Then enlighten me, Enrilitus. What do I think? You think Mother has compromised Father?" Another fraction of hesitation. Mathanet's gaze drifted in and out of focus. Enrilitus seized the opportunity. "You think Mother has blunted Father's pursuit of the shortest path, time and again, that he walks in arcs to appease her heart, when he should cleave to the ruthless lines of a thousandfold thought?" Again the Holy Shrier of the Thousand Temples hesitated. Perhaps Enrilitus had found the thread. Perhaps Uncle could be unmasked. Perhaps Mathanet should be counted weak in their small tribe. "Who has told you these things?" his uncle demanded. Enrilitus ignored the distraction. "You think Father risks the very world for his empress's sake, for the absurdity of love. Was it her? Did she tell you about the thousandfold thought?"
"And you see me,"
the naked adolescent pressed. "The fact that I have been caged rather than drowned, as the most glaring example of your elder brother's folly." Again Kel-Momus watched his uncle's eyes fall out of focus, then return. An outward sign of the probability trance. It wasn't fair, he decided, that he should be born with all these gifts, yet be denied the training required to forge true weapons out of them. What use was Father to him so long as he let him flounder? How could the Aspect Emperor be anything but his son's greatest threat, greatest foe, when he always saw more? More deeply. "I fear that you might be," the Shrier said. "I admit as much. But if you can see this, Enrilitus, then your father has seen it also, and far more completely. If he sees no sedition in my fearing, why should you?" Once again, his uncle tried to seize the initiative with questions of his own. Once again, Enrilitus simply ignored him and pressed on with his interrogation. "Tell me, uncle, how will you have me killed when you seize power?" "These tricks, Enrilitus, these tactics, they only work when they are hidden. I see these things the same as you."
"Strange, isn't it, uncle? The way we do Nyane for all our gifts can never
We are speaking now. And Religious laughed at this, lowered his beard-hazed cheek to his knees once again. But how can that be when we mean nothing of what we say? You come... What would they do, you think, if men could see us? If they could fathom the way we don and doff them like clothes? Mathenet shrugged. What would any child do if they could fathom their father? Imrilitus smiled. That depends on the father. This is the answer you want me to speak. No, that is the answer. More laughter, so like the Aspect Emperor's that goose pimples climbed across the boy's skin. You really believe that we Dunyane differ? That like fathers, some can be good, some bad? I know so, Mathenet replied. There was something coiled about his brother, Kelmormis decided. The way he lolled his head, flexed his wrists, and rocked on his heels created an impression of awkward, effeminate youth. A false impression. The more harmless he seemed, the young Prince Imperial understood, the more lethal he became. All of this, the secret voice warned, is simply for show. And that was the joke, Kelmormis realized. Inrilitus truly meant nothing of what he said. "Oh, we have our peculiarities, I grant you that," the adolescent said. "Our hash of strengths and weaknesses. But in the end we all suffer the same miraculous disease. Reflection. Where they think, one thought following hard upon the other, tripping forward blindly. We reflect." Each thought grasps the thought before it, like a starving dog chasing an oh-so-meaty tail. They stumble before us reeling like drunks, insensible to their momentary origins, and we unravel them. Play them like instruments, plucking songs of love and adoration that they call their own. Something was going to happen. Kelmormis found himself leaning forward, such was his hanker. When? When? We all deceive, Uncle. All of us, all the time. That is the gift of reflection. They make their choices, Mathenet said in a head-shaking tone. Please, Uncle, you must speak before me the way you speak before Father. I see your lies, no matter how banal or cunning. No choices are made in our presence, ever. You know this. The only freedom is freedom over. Very well, then, the Holy Shrier replied. I tire of your philosophy, Inrilitus. I find you abhorrent, and I fear this entire exercise simply speaks to your mother's failing reason. Mother! The older brother exclaimed. You think Mother arranged this? A heartbeat of hesitation, the smallest crack in Mathenet's false demeanor.
Something is wrong. The voice whispered.
If not her, then who? The Shrier of the Thousand Temples asked. Inrilitus at once frowned and smiled, his expression drunk with exaggeration, his eyebrows hooked high. He glanced down at his little brother. Kelmormis? Mathenet asked, not with the incredulity appropriate to a human, but in the featureless voice belonging to the Dunyane. Inrilitus gazed at the young Prince Imperial as if he were a puppy about to be thrown into a river. Poor boy. A thousand words and insinuations battered them day in and day out, the youth said. But because they lack the memory to enumerate them, they forget. They find themselves stranded with hopes and suspicions not of their making. Mother has always loved you, Uncle, has always seen you as a more human version of Father, an illusion you have labored long and hard to cultivate. Now, suddenly, when she most desperately needs your counsel, she fears and hates you. And this is Kelmormis's work. He isn't what he seems, Uncle. Mathenet glanced at the boy, who stood as rigid as a shield next to him, then turned back to Inrilitus. Kelmormis did not know what he found more terrifying, the unscalable surfaces of his uncle's face, or his brother's sudden betrayal.
"I have suspected as much," the Shrier said.
"Say something," the voice urged.
Enrilatus nodded as if rueing some tragic fact. "As mad as all of us are, as much heartbreak as we have heaped upon our mother, he is, I think, the worst of us. Surely you know he was the one who killed Semiramis." Another crack in his uncle's once impervious demeanor. It was all the young Prince Imperial could do to simply stand and breathe. All his crimes he had committed in the shadow of assumption. Were his uncle to suspect him capable of murdering Semiramis, Sherakinth, he would have quickly seen his guilt. Such were his gifts. But for all their strength, the Dunyane remained as blind to ignorance as the world born, and as vulnerable. And now, never in his short life had Kelmomus experienced the terror he now felt, the sense of flushing looseness, as if he were a pillar of water about to collapse in a thousand liquid directions, the sense of binding tension, as if an inner winch cranked at every thread of his being, throttled him vein by vein. And he found it curious, just as he found this curiosity curious.
"Semiramis died playing a foolish prank," Mathanet said evenly. "I was there. And my little brother, he was there also?"
"Yes." "And Kelmomus, does he not share our gift for leading fools?"
"He could, in time."
"But what if he were like me, uncle? What if he were born knowing how to use our gifts?"
Kelmomus could hear all three of their hearts, his beating with rabid quickness, his uncle's pounding as slow as a bull's, his brother's dancing through the erratic in-between.
"You are saying he murdered his own brother?"
Enrilatus nodded the way mother nodded when affirming unfortunate truths.
"And others?"
"Others?" Kelmomus stood, immobilized by astonishment.
"How? How? How could everything turn so quickly?"
"Turn to him, uncle. Use your portion. Gaze into his face and ask him if he is a fratricide. What was the mad fool doing? His uncle was the one. He was the one who needed to be humiliated, destroyed." The Shrier of the Thousand Temples turned to the boy, not as a human might, frowning, questioning, but with the glint of void in his eyes, as a Dunyane.
"The sum of sins," Enrilatus continued. "There is nothing more godly than murder, nothing more absolute."
And for the first time Kelmomus found himself trapped within the dead circuit of his uncle's scrutiny.
"Hide!" the secret voice cried. "He glimpses! Glimpses!"
"Come now, Kelmomus," his brother cackled. "Show Uncle Holy why you should be chained in my place."
"Liar!"
the boy finally shrieked in a blubbering denial.
"Lies!"
"Kelmomus!" the Shrier shouted, his voice yanking on every string of authority from parental to religious. "Turn to me! Look to me and tell me! Did you murder?" Two clicks, almost simultaneous. Two screeches. A noise as small as mice trampled underfoot. The whir of flying iron. Links snapping. Fire-weakened links snapping. One chain whooshed over the boy's head, while the other hooked behind his uncle. They intersected, lashed in opposing directions about the post of Uncle Holy's neck. Wound like whips. Kelmomus had scarcely torn his eyes away from his uncle, when his brother heaved, throwing his arms out and back like wings, his spine arched like a bow. Mathanet flew headlong to his feet. Then Enrilatus had him, pulled him, for all his stature, like a child, against his chest. He roared in bestial exultation, wrenched at the chains again and again. And Kelmomus watched the Shrier of the Thousand Temples strangle. Mathanet was on his knees, his face darkening, frantic hands grubbing at the chains, His silken sleeves had dropped down, revealing the fine, wrought beauty of his band braces. Enrilatus screamed and twisted. His arms, chest, and shoulders grooved with exertion. Mathanet surrendered his breath, fought only to protect his carotid artery. Enrilatus wrenched once, twice, violently enough to lift Uncle from his knees. But in a heartbeat of dropping slack, Mathanet's left hand fluttered across the vambrace on the forearm opposite. A blade appeared, jutting a finger's length beyond his elbow. It gleamed as though wet. The first strike puffed the spark from Enrilatus's eyes. The second, low on his ribs, occasioned no more than a flinch. The chain slipped from the adolescent's grasp. Mathanet fell forward to his hands. He choked for air, as would any mortal, but recovered far more quickly. In mere heartbeats, it seemed, he had cast aside the chains and whirled to confront his dying nephew. Enrilatus had staggered back two steps, his mouth gaping, his hand pawing the blood welling from his side. No words needed to be exchanged. Muffled shouts and hammering could already be heard at the door. The Shrier of the Thousand Temples could not trust a madman's dying words. He raised his fist. His strike caught the adolescent utterly unprepared. His left brow and socket collapsed like bread crust. The Prince Imperial fell back. The clink of iron accompanied the slap of his nude body across the floor. He jerked, as if possessed by fire. Blood chased the creases between the floor stones. Soft, Mathanet said, as if noting a natural curiosity. He turned to the dumbstruck boy, his right sleeve crimson with blood. And you, he asked without a whisper of passion, do you have your mother's bones? The bronze door burst open. Both uncle and nephew whirled to the faces massed beyond the threshold. Angry and astounded eyes probed the gloom, sorted the living from the dead.
"Mommy, mommy, mommy!"
Kel'Momas shrieked to the lone porcelain mask in the crowd's midst.
"Uncle moves against you. He killed Inri to keep you from knowing."
But his mother had already caught sight of her prostrate son, had already jostled her way to the fore. "Esme," Mathanet began. "You have to understand—"
"I don't care how it happened,"
she interrupted, drifting more than walking from the form of her son on the floor, his flushed nakedness becoming ever more gray. She teetered over him as if he were a fatal plummet. "Did you do this, Esme?" the Shrier persisted, his voice imperious. "Did you plan this to—"
"Did I do what?"
she said in a voice so calm it could only be crazed. "Plan for you to murder my son?" "Esme," he began. But some sights commanded silence, even from a Dunyane. For several giddy, horrifying moments, Kel'Momas did not so much see his mother slump to her knees as he saw the Empress of the Three Seas collapse. A stranger. He told himself it was the mask, but when she pulled it from her face, the profile of cheek and brow did not seem familiar to him. Holding the thing in ginger fingers, she set it upon Enrilatus's shattered brow. Low thunder rumbled through the cell. Rain hissed and thrummed. "Before," she said, her head still down, "before, I knew I could defeat you." The Holy Shrier of the Thousand Temples stood imperious and scowling. "How?" She shrugged like someone weary beyond all suffering. "A story Kellis once told me about a wager between a god and a hero. A test of courage." Mathanet watched her with the absolute absence of expression. She looked up to him, her eyes red and welling. "I sometimes think he was warning me. Against him, against my children, against you." She turned back to her dead son. "He told me this story revealed the great vulnerability of the Dunyane." She brushed a lock of hair from the mask upon Enrilatus's face. Blood had continued to drain, pooling, chasing the seams, soaking the nethers of her gown.
You need only be willing to sacrifice yourself.
Esme, you have been dis—
I was so willing, Maetha.
And I knew you would see this in me, realize that I would let all the Empire burn to war against you, that you would capitulate the way all the others had capitulated to my sovereign will.
Esmanet, sister, please, relinquish this mad—
But what? What you have done? Here? Her head dropped like a doll's, and her voice faded to a whisper.
Maetha, you have killed my boy. My son.
She frowned, as if only now grasping the consequences, then glared at her exalt captain.
Imhalas, seize him!
They crowded about the entrance, a small mob of astounded souls. Until now, the statuesque Nosirai officer had stood motionless, watching with a horrified pallor. Now Kelmomus almost giggled, so comic was his shock.
Your glory?
Esme, Maethanet said, something dark growling through his voice. I will not be taken. He simply turned and began striding down the memorial halls. Silence, stunned and panting.
Seize him!
The Holy Empress screeched at Imhalas. She turned back to the corpse of her son, hung over him, murmuring,
No, 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 no,
against the shudders that racked her slender frame.
Not another one,
the secret voice whispered, laughing. Her body slaves had only attended to a handful of lanterns before she chased them from her apartments. Darkness ruled the clutch of interconnected rooms as a result, punctuated by pools of lonely illumination. In the boy's eyes, the world seemed soft and warm with secrets, all the edges rounded with shadow. The belly of an urn gleaming here, the combed planes of a tapestry hanging there, familiar things, made strange for the scarcity of light. Yes, he decided. A different world. Better.
They lay together on the broad bed, she with her back partially propped on pillows, he within her sheltering curve. Neither of them spoke. For the longest time, the gauze shears drawn across the balcony were all that moved, gently teasing the marble shadows. The Prince Imperial had set an idle fraction of his soul, the task of counting heartbeats, so that he might know the measure of his bliss. 3,427 passed before Lord Sancus appeared from the darkened depths, his face drawn for worry.
He simply walked out of the palace.
The Empress stiffened but did not move
otherwise. No one would dare raise arms against him?
No one. Not even Imhalas?
Sancus nodded. Imhalas, yes, but none of his men assisted him. Kelmomus fairly squirmed for excitement.
Please, 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 let him be dead.
Enrilitus gone. Uncle Holy banished from the palace. Imhalas dead would make this a most perfect of perfect days. But his mother had gone rigid behind him.
Is he okay?
The fool's pride will be splinted for a month, but his body is intact. May I suggest, your glory, that he be relieved of his command?
No, Sancus.
His men mutinied, your glory, and for all eyes to see. His hold over them, his command is now broken. I said no.
More than his command has been broken.
All of us have been damaged this day.
The patrician's eyes widened in acknowledgment.
Of course, your glory.
A forlorn moment passed, filled with all the things that rise into the place of hopes dashed. Paroxysms had swept through her, rising and falling with the swells of her grief. She had clutched and released him, clutched and released, as if something had groped through her, making a glove of her skin, fingers of her limbs. Now her hold on him relaxed and her breathing slowed. Even the rhythm of her heart became thick and swollen. And somehow the boy just knew that she had found peace in a fatal resolution.
"Europratodromos, Sancus," she said.
He could feel the heat of her breath on his scalp, so he knew that she stared down at him, melancholy and adoring. "You belong to one of the most ancient houses. You have ways, resources, utterly independent of the imperial apparati. I am sure you can provide me with what I need."
"Anything, your glory."
Kelmomus closed his eyes, floated in the luxurious sensation of her fingers twining through his curls.
"I need someone, Sancus," she said from the darkness immediately above him. "I need someone... someone who can kill."
A long, appreciative pause. "Any man can kill another, Empress." Words, like flakes of poison, a mere handful could overturn the world. "I need someone with skills, miraculous skills." The Patrodomos went rigid.
"Yes," he said tightly.
"I see." Lord Beoxysancus was a son of a different age, possessing sensibilities that never quite fit the new order father had established. He continually did things that struck the boy as odd, like the way he not only dared approach his empress, but actually sat upon the edge of her bed. He gazed at her with bold candor. The play of dim light and shadow did not flatter him, drawing deep as it did the long ruts of his face. "Narinder," he said with a solemn nod. The young Prince Imperial struggled to preserve the drowsy sorrow of his gaze. He had heard no few tales about the Narinder, the cultic assassins, whose name had been synonymous with dread. That is, before father had unmasked the first of the consult skin spies. Funny how men had only so much room for their fears.
"I can arrange everything if you wish, your glory."
"No, Sancus. This I must command myself." She caught her breath by biting her lower lip. "The damnation must be mine alone."
Damned? Did Mother think she would be damned for murdering Uncle Holy? "She doesn't believe this," the secret voice whispered. "She doesn't believe a Dunyain can be a true anything, let alone a holy shrier."
"I understand your glory," Beoxysancus said, nodding and smiling a humorless smile that reminded the boy of Uncle Proyas and his melancholy devotion. "And I admire." And the boy craned his head up to see the tears at last overwhelm her eyes. It was becoming more difficult, finding ways to make her cry. She clutched her boy tight, as if he were her only limb remaining. The gaunt Patrodomos bowed precisely as low as Jeannine demanded of him, then withdrew to afford his empress the privacy that all anguish required.